Okay, well, I should introduce my august guest today, Alan Runyon, co-founder of Plone, president of Enfold Systems. It's been around since the beginning of Plone. I don't know. I mean, this is pretty, I would say this has got to be the coup for the Plone podcast to be able to interview.
Awesome.
And yeah, of course, I was telling Alan, I got my t-shirt out. And this little doohickey that my friend made for the Plone Symposium here in Oshkosh in 2013. It's meant to be, I don't know, earrings. What do you think?
Yeah, I think earrings would work well. I think I like how like the background sort of diffused that into the background. Is really cool.
Thanks for coming, Alan.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. I'm just going to be drinking my tea through the conversation, if you don't mind.
See, I was thinking of getting a beer, but
there you go. That would be the Python/Plone conference way.
I mean, it is the afternoon.
That's right.
Somewhere. No, it really is the afternoon for us. But I'm trying to think. So the last time I saw you in person was in Tokyo.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. That was really cool.
How long did you stay for at the con? Because you've got this knack of flying in and flying out.
Yeah, I didn't stay for very long, unfortunately, for some personal reasons I had come up. But yeah, I was there and got to see everyone at a dinner or two and in some of the evening affairs. And it was pretty amazing. I mean, Jim Fulton was there and Ramon and it was really good. It was really good. And you, and I mean, it was just fantastic seeing everyone.
Did you actually get to work a lot with Jim?
No, just basically, you know, at Python conferences, asking questions, at a few sprints, you know, and pretty much that's about it. Really, really good guy.
Smart like a whip.
I had the most sort of personal interactions I had was probably with Trey Siever, who lived in Houston before he moved over to Virginia to work at Zip Corp. That was really interesting. But Jim, no, not really. I wish he had more time to spend on the ZDB. It's a really interesting piece of technology.
I guess. Just the other day, I was talking to a team who were interested in using Plone, adopting Plone, actually kind of re-adopting Plone, because they used to use it as an intranet, then they stopped that, and then now they want to switch from a commercial platform to Plone. And I was talking to the director of that team, and I was saying, yeah, you know, Plone, because that person was looking at the details of like documentation and so on, and said, we kind of need some kind of tour guide, equivalent to a tour guide, to kind of give us a lay of the land. And here's how you might do something in some other platform. And how would you do the same thing in Plone? Because I guess it's different enough. And I said to this person, yeah, you know, I remember at the university here in Oshkosh, when I first started using Plone as a content management system, and then realized that you could do all these amazing things with archetypes, and you could just save content and data into this database. And I was going, well, this is perfect. I need a web application framework. Why not try using Plone? And I scoured the documentation and the user guide. And I was going like, how do I save data to the database? How do I read data from the database? Yeah, and it took me quite a while to finally clue in. Oh my God, it's just invisible. It's transparent. You don't have to do anything. It's just done for you. All you got to do is inherit from this one class, and you don't even have to do that. Is you just use the content types.
Sure, sure.
Mind blowing.
Yeah, I mean, that was. I think everyone has that issue when they come to it. If they're, you know, depending on which way they're engaging the system. I mean, the transparency part is pretty controversial. You know, a lot of people love it and are sort of enamored by it. And then there are other people who are just absolutely loathe it and just think that it's, you know, from a framework point of view, it's just not, you know, it's not really a kosher way of doing things. And I can see it both ways. I mean, mm-hmm. you know,
but if you're
abusing it, then you can really make a mess. But
who would ever do anything like that?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I was actually thinking about one time, thinking about having this conversation with you and the random times I've been talking to people about Plone or the ZDB even, and then having conversations with people and asking them, oh yeah, so like we find ourselves in these kinds of positions where we are making policy decisions based on hierarchies and you know, we want to reuse all the code. And then, you know, just people looking at me going like, what on earth are you talking about? You know, you just, you know, you make another regex and then you just call a whole nother set of code at this area. And mm-hmm. it's like, wow, yeah, that's one way of doing it for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So the CODB, I mean, I just think it's a marvel. It's another one of those inventions in Zope or Plone that our communities came up with and just kind of blazed a trail, and then people just ignored it. It was kind of sad, really.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, you know, I don't think that most people have an affinity towards, well, I mean, you have to understand, I mean, this was done years before a lot of the sort of schemaless databases came out in Mongo and all these, and those actually have a language neutral, you know, protocol. So, you know, you can actually talk across multiple different languages, whether it's Node or this or that, the other, and it's binary. So in ZODB land, it was just Python. Right. And so I think that between that being something that concerned people and the fact that it is really this kind of implicit, your application and your data are really intimately merged is, you know, it's worrying for some people.
I've seen the other way.
I think it's like pretty fantastic.
Yeah. As a developer, as somebody who wants to advocate for adoption of Plone in developer teams or in institutions, I mean, to me, it's like, it's just so easy and transparent. Yes, you can get yourself into performance issues if you do crazy stuff, but if all you care about is reading and writing your content so you can manipulate it and then save it again, my gosh, there's nothing easier.
Yeah.
I was going to comment on your mention of Python, because back then at the beginning of Plone, Python was like somewhat obscure. Wasn't really popular. It was kind of a neat thing. I remember in 1996 having to learn how to use it and thinking, okay, this is cool, but there's nothing really spectacularly different about it other than a clean syntax. And then now today, or like basically in the last 3 or 4 years, Python has just like exploded. It's what one of the most popular, or if not the most popular, development language. And people are using it for machine learning and data science and all sorts of data manipulation. It's fascinating to see how popular it's become. And so now when I talk to a potential client or an organization, I don't have to justify that Plone is Python. They go, oh sure. Yeah, we like Python because it's so popular.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a complete flip from in the beginning. I mean, really when at the beginning, I would say 94, or so, 95, I don't even remember, not 90s. When was I going to Python conferences? I guess 2002, 2001. I don't even remember. I'd have to go back and look at the dates. It was a long time ago at this point. And, you know, the conference size was pretty small. I mean, it was probably, you know, I don't know, 400 people, 300 people. And all the people who were, you know, being someone who was new and walking around, it was like all of these just, you know, rocket ship smart people who were doing really weird things that were just mind boggling. I had no idea. I was just out of college and looking at, you know, asking people at the bar, hey, you know, so what do you guys do at wherever you're at? And just not even understanding what they're saying and nodding along. Just, wow, that sounds really, really crazy. I like it. Now it's not like that.
Is your degree in computer science?
Yeah. I got into Python when I first got out of school and I was just sort of hunting around for jobs. The only job I sort of easily sort of fell into was doing some custom programming in Visual Basic, which then quickly went into COM. And then when I was at COM World, you know, the thing that kind of piqued my interest was Python. And so Mark Lutz or Mark Hammond's book on Win32 COM programming was the thing that I was really interested in.
Why?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I think that I ended up finding Python through a friend of mine who is a musician. And he was saying, hey man, there's this programming language called Python. It's like really easy. Even I can do it. And I was like, okay, so what does this look like? And I want to say that he was using BOS. Or something like that. And so I sat down and we're looking at some of the synthesizer software and, very, very primitive stuff back then. And I found it really interesting and just kind of looked into it. And then it wasn't very long after that, this weird thing called Zope came out. And I think I may even have found that on Slashdot at the time.
Oh, yeah. Are you still on Slashdot?
No, I haven't. I haven't gone to Slashdot in a long time, actually. I thought it was a great place to go. It was sort of during the .com boom, sort of the place, ground zero to catch up on news.
So did you follow the kids to Reddit?
So I was really late in the Reddit game.
Still not really there.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes browse it. I would say I browse it, you know, pretty frequently. But I still ended up typing in URLs to go to websites.
It's so easy now. There's autocomplete. There's all this history stuff. I mean, things are so easy now. I mean, you've seen the thing from GitHub where they've got that, I can't remember what they call it now, Copilot, where you just start typing comments and boom, code's written. Hey, where's the skill?
Actually, I have not. I've read something on Hacker News around Copilot, but I haven't really followed up or looked into it. It's interesting, as you know, as we're getting older, that the amount of time where we end up focusing on things. I mean, that the Copilot stuff sounds so interesting, right? And this idea that, I mean, I haven't looked at any of the machine learning stuff that is claiming to be able to program things.
Yeah, there are flaws. It's an interesting experiment and maybe it'll be useful and maybe it won't. But the whole concept is that they just go through open source code, whether it's good or bad. It's in a public repo. They scan it, they use it. And then they try to match what you've written in your comments to what the code is that matches the comments. And then they just spit out the code. And maybe it's good. Maybe it's a crappy algorithm. Maybe it's got vulnerabilities in it. It doesn't matter. But it kind of at least gives you some idea. Maybe. So if you're starting out, you can at least have something to work from starting.
Yeah. Point. Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting. I'd have to see sort of how that would play out. I did see briefly that Microsoft had some sort of ML completion they wanted to add to Visual Studio Code or VS Code. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it's called. And that was something, I guess, probably being driven by some of the GitHub stuff. Interesting.
I think it's all intertwined now because they just announced this code spaces thing on GitHub where, what is it now? If you are looking at a PR, you can immediately get some kind of IDE in the browser and maybe a whole development environment. I just saw it, but right. It's, wow. They're slowly, I think part of it, I assume, is that they want to ditch the whole GitHub developers use Macs to develop. I mean, now that it's Microsoft owned, they're not going to want that, right? Strategically, mm-hmm. I would assume. But I can't say anything too mean about Microsoft because at this conference, you know, in Boston, I'll have to say it because Microsoft donated the conference space, a whole floor for a conference. And it wasn't just Plone, because it's not just because they love Plone, but they love open source projects, and they have this space that's for any open source project. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So that pretty much shut me up. I can't complain too much more about Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to remember that Microsoft was, you know, pretty much one of the main open source, sort of not even open source, just even language innovators. I mean, in the early 2000s, I mean, Python server pages inside of ASP were, I mean, no one else was embedding Python into their runtimes. I mean, and you know, you have, you know, dot or ASP, active server pages, having a, you know, language equals text Python. And there you go. You get to embed your Python directly into their runtime, calling into Python and calling into COM objects and all those sorts of things. It's pretty far out. And there's a lot of things that Microsoft had bought. I mean, they have really, really strong, you know, development tools. I mean, their tooling is what I can tell, you know, light years ahead of Mac when it comes to empowering developers.
Really, what specifically?
The visual code experience, you know, bringing it up and being able to work is, to me, I mean, maybe also because I'm not an Xcode developer, is just more intuitive. There is a paradigm there that Mac uses that's not just the file editor paradigm, I believe. I think it's more of like a project oriented slash
the integrated.
It's fully integrated where it's not just a file editor. And so there's that. But I on a whole, you know, my experience with Xcode is pretty, I don't spend enough time in it to really find it to get any sort of real skill in it. But you know, a really close friend of mine was talking to me about the Xcode development, some of the profiling and some of the tooling they have for native Swift apps. Actually, back then it was sort of Objective-C, and that just, they're pretty rudimentary. And when I see, and when I look at Xcode, or when I look at VS Code with sort of their language servers and some of these features, where I mean, it's pretty magical being able to develop locally, develop over SSH, develop inside of a container. I mean, it's all there, and it feels sort of, it really does feel like magic in some ways.
That's I think of VS Code, because I'm not really in the Windows world. I think of VS Code as like they're doing what PyCharm, for example, does on other platforms. But I haven't actually used Xcode very much. I find the whole local app development ecosystem kind of mind-bogglingly complex. But I guess anything like Plone, people can say Plone looks really complex too. But
sure.
I was just thinking in terms of the development experience, not for building native apps, but just as a developer, what kind of tools would you want to use? Would you want to use a Mac? Would you want to use a Linux box? Would you use a Windows box? And certainly I know that Macs suffer right now from, if you want to use Docker, it's not really running very quickly. Right. It's a resource hog. So that's a problem for developers who want to use Macs.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't been using, any Docker work I do, I just do it on Linux, and also I'm not doing too much development work these days. But really, when I'm I tried to install, I think, Docker locally, and it was requiring VirtualBox and all this other stuff. I think it was coming along for the ride. And it's just, I never really spent enough time sort of figuring out how is this working and why is it working this way? Because it doesn't seem like it's behaving the same as on Linux. And I had some problems with Faust, which was this sort of Robinhood Kafka kind of framework. It looks really cool. And I was evaluating it. And on Mac, it was just a nightmare. And instead of even trying to debug it, I was just, all right, let's see what this, how this works on Linux. And of course it just came up. I mean, I think I'm still on Mac as well. I mean, I love it. I mean, it's really pretty and it's probably the most expensive, terminal, that I've ever used, but that's kind of what, I mean, I find myself doing is either inside of a terminal or something that looks like Emacs or VS Code or a web browser nowadays.
I didn't even have to pay you to say Emacs. There are a lot of people who are going to be teasing me after they listen to this. No, but I was using Emacs and then for years, right? So I think I started using it as a grad student. Even before 87. My little story about Emacs contribution. I found a bug in Emacs in a malloc call, and I sent in a bug report, and Richard Stallman replied to it. And he said, oh, thanks for the fix.
There we go.
But maybe I shouldn't say Richard Stallman's name out loud too much right now.
I haven't followed the political stuff. But one of the things that we used to do, though, when I was a kid, this is before I was probably about high school level, is when we had actually access to the internet, is that the AI machines on MIT's computers were just, you could log in with guest. Right, you just tell that to them and just log in as guest.
All right, I didn't even try that. You know that is a federal crime now.
Probably, yeah. I want to say that I think there may have been a banner or something that said, you know, you can do it. Walk right on in, guys. And then, of course,
go ahead.
Kids just messing with the whole system.
I remember Waterloo just going through all the FTP servers and thinking, oh, this is MIT. Oh, this is Madison. I had no idea it was Madison. But it was amazing. It was really wide open then. And I remember thinking, hey, I can do and say anything I want on this internet or the Usenet, and no one can accuse me of doing anything because there's no laws that apply to this.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is a different world now. I mean, I don't follow Twitter or any sort of the main social things I was really involved with were open source and the phone community. Online socially, I don't really engage with Twitter or Facebook. Facebook, I stopped a while back. But the original, the sort of old school Lynx style Netscape internet was really, really different world than what we have today, you know. And you know, get off my lawn, I guess, it sounds like old man talking. But it really was quite interesting. I mean, there was no, you know, I mean, I can sort of almost feel what it was like to be, you know, 17 or 18 years old, and I would have had a very negative reaction towards sort of political correctness or any of these sort of movements. I mean, there was really a kind of, you know, I don't know, sort of very libertarian ethos of a identification with non-identification or some sort of subculture. You know, a friend of mine was recently telling me how subcultures no longer exist, that we're living inside of a giant sort of global culture that kind of has subsumed things. And who knows, but I can tell you that I think that there was a distinct subculture back when the computer started that doesn't really exist in that way, but that maybe that's just the self-centeredness of me being able to sort of see how things are now.
I think there definitely was a different feel to anything that was on the internet because it was a technical elite. I mean, you had to be at either a military or a government institution or a university that was connected to the internet, and you had to be one of the privileged few who had an account on one of the servers that was connected to the internet. And so and it wasn't easy to learn how to do that. You had to be very comfortable with command line and like all these arcane commands and ways of connecting. And first of all, just logging into a darn thing. Like, what are you talking about? You have to have a modem, a terminal. What's a terminal? What's the terminal settings? I can't remember the transmission protocols that you have to set. And then you can get to the command prompt or to the login and then the command. So right, I think it's just there was such a high bar to getting in that anybody who got in already had common ground. And so it felt a lot like home, even though you were meeting people who were doing different things. They all had to meet that high bar to get in. And so I think it's just us being kind of snooty.
Yeah, it probably is. I have to admit that talking to people in the phone community, it was really interesting where some of the people whom, you know, had sort of a similar trajectory to me, Joel Burton being one of them, was just so interesting sitting, talking around. So how the hell did you end up here in this sort of shared, you know, the same place? And, you know, and just the trajectory was so remarkably similar, you know, of how we ended up online and ended up in, you know, socializing online and programming and doing these sorts of things. I mean, I guess now it's just, it's so ubiquitous. It's just, we don't even think about it. It's sort of like air.
Although you're right, it is ubiquitous and the internet is all around us in different forms. You can, you know, all these ways that you can do something that happens to be on the internet, but it feels to me like it's gotten so easy and so invisible in a way that kids don't even, I still think most kids don't think of the internet as something that they can get good at. They just consume it. So I think people have been turned into just consumers. And so the possibilities for us that when like 30 years ago or longer, of using that as a means for reaching out to other people and finding uniquely qualified somehow other people who are similar to us is different. And now it's very popular, consumerized. I don't think they think of programming anymore when they think of the internet, which is a shame.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I gotta ask you. I wanna hear more about, and I'm sorry if you've been asked this a lot. I want to hear more about the story of the founding of Plone, because what I had heard was that you and Alex Leamy, one of you had lost his job and one of you had lost his girlfriend. Is that right? Or is that just
it's actually not too far from it, I think. So let's see. So the .com bust had happened. Zope, I had been using Zope for a bit. I was looking for a job. I found a job. I was doing some Zope work, and sort of while I was working, this is the first job I had where I was just sort of a contractor. I was kind of coding during the day and, you know, talking to a customer. It wasn't on site. And so I'm sitting on FNet, or it may have been Downnet back then. I don't remember which IRC network it was. And we're talking, and somehow Leamy and I ended up talking about Zope and CMF and the content management framework that Zope Corp had written, and just talking, just sort of, hey, you know, this would be kind of cool to make really, you know, easily consumable by making it pretty and maybe making some more decisions around it. And it really kind of went something like that, where, you know, hey, let's make it look a little bit nicer. And Leamy, I guess, you know, having broken up with his girlfriend and looking for some place to put his energy was cranking out CSS and HTML and then sending it back to me and then me sort of filling it in and us going back and forth.
Wow. How long did you guys do that?
Man, it wasn't very long. It was probably about 3 months or so until we showed it off to someone. And that was just in, I want to say 3 months. I honestly don't even know at this point.
So you showed it off to someone who
I think it was probably Paul Everett. I think it was Paul Everett. And if I remember correctly, it was shown off through the sort of import-export mechanism inside the Zope management interface, because you could write everything inside of the ZODB and export container structures and then re-import them in. And actually, that's how we were doing the development is, Leemi didn't have, I'm not even sure if Leemi, I'll be honest with you. I mean, at that point, there was such little documentation with it. So without having something like that or sort of a frictionless way of adding, you know, methods and adding HTML and CSS and making changes, it didn't take, we knew how to do it on the file system, but, you know, I mean, it would have been one more layer of us having to put some stuff in place. And I think that low bar was so low that it allowed us to just immediately do it without having any thoughts, you know, almost virtually zero setup. I mean, it was really fun.
You're really making me think here, because you're talking about making things frictionless, and I especially the through the web development for Plone. It seems like we've all digested a little bit. We thought about this a lot, chewed on this a lot. What was it that made Plone so popular at the beginning? And then starting around Plone 3 made things harder for people to adopt because file system development started to become like the no-no. And so the people who were tinkering and who had taken advantage of that really low bar, that frictionless way of coding and then using acquisition and all those amazing things that Plone can do if you know how. And then you worry later maybe that maybe it wasn't really scalable or it was hard to replicate what you'd done. So, I mean, that frictionless thing is so, seems so important, so key to adoption of any system.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the interesting parts now where, you know, you have Visual Studio Code in the browser practically, mm-hmm. or I'm not sure if that's what the GitHub thing you were talking about was, but that is something that I saw.
Sounds like it.
At Microsoft, which was essentially Visual Studio Code running inside the browser. And when it's at that level, then we're really kind of where Plone was attempting to be, you know, and Zope was really attempting to be 20 years ago. But I think that the separation of concerns wasn't clear enough. And not everything can be treated as a class and can be treated as, which is essentially what ends up happening is a HTML document as a class. Yeah, and everything's an object of some type. And that, you know, I mean, that was always sort of an issue. We're kind of not really treating static assets as static assets really in the system. They're these object kind of things and they contain static assets. And I've never done any small talk work, but I presume it made sense for that group of people. Recently, we were talking to a senior engineer who had never heard of ZODB or Python. And he kind of was just shaking his head going, you know, I guess it sounds like a good idea.
That's a great motto. I love that. One of the things that at 6 Feet Up, people have been talking about, like the phrase, it depends. Like if you're talking to a senior developer, how to do a thing, and then the answer is never clear, it's always, well, it kind of depends. But it seemed like a good idea. That's a good one. The other thing you said about when you were working and coming up with Plone, the idea, is that you made decisions. And that's a really nice way to, that captures a lot of some of the issues with tools that are maybe too general. And if someone makes some decisions and makes it easier, you limit in a way what people can do with that tool, but you also make it clearer how they can use that tool. And I think maybe that's probably better to err in that direction than in making a thing too general.
Yeah, I mean, if that's if your goal is a group of people who are okay with that, then it's great. I mean, in user in applications, we do that all the time, right? I mean, we really limit things down and we try to reduce the amount of, you know, user interactions and having sort of default policies that, will ensure that the person is not having to know that the system behaves a certain way, but that this that it's mostly about the user interactions and less about the system structure, the system data, you know, the operations the system is doing under the hood, and more at a higher level. And I think that that was probably one of the more interesting things about Plone that people liked. If it was just a framework and you could have pieced together, you know, it just wasn't really like that. It was really trying to attempt to be a product that people could use out of the box.
I think you, and that was you interesting. You hit it out of the ballpark, because when I, in 2003, when I was looking for some way to let people build and maintain a website, Plone was like, oh my God, like you not only made decisions, but you put all the features in it that anybody could possibly have imagined needing. and it just blew my mind that where the hell did this thing come from? Because it's so freaking complete. I shouldn't swear.
Well, I mean, a lot of the stuff that Plone was getting kudos for was being done by the underlying framework. It was just that it was exposing a lot of that stuff. And it was really kind of Lee, me, and I's decision, you know, where it was like, hey, listen, let's just make this more accessible. So we expose it and show people that it's useful.
Well, I mean, as a content editor, you know, being able to, log in, the what you see is what you get editor, all the meta. Okay. Anyway, I don't need to go into review of all the features Plone out of the box, but it still is a spectacular content management system. And people talk about, oh yeah, I can write my own content management system functionality in, you know, Django or something else. And I go, right, have you looked at the feature list over here? you try to implement that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that, I mean, it's still being used. And for some cases, it's pretty useful. I mean, for a generalized system, I mean, it's not going to be the most ergonomic for all cases. For some subset of cases, it's going to work pretty well. I mean, there's a lot of regrets and about sort of some of the decisions that were made. But I mean, on a whole, you know, we are where we are, and it's worked out well for a majority of people, and a lot of people hopefully have learned and gone on to build other products, and yeah, that's as much as you can ask for.
If I think about all the people who were doing Plone at some time, sometimes for a long time, and have moved into all sorts of very well-known technology companies or services, and they're just building amazing things. And there's sort of an alumni. There should be an alumni. Well, there kind of is an alumni association of Plonistas, because, I mean, there's some pretty big names out there, people who've gone on to build really notable things who had come from sort of starting in Plone.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with Python in general, because, you know, I mean, we think about even Django. I think Django it's got to be 10 years old at this point. I mean, so, you know, and Python, you know, was starting to get popular when Django was taking off, and whatever the predecessor for Flask was. And I can't remember what it's called, Wurzburg or something like that. That actually is part of Flask, but that was around about the same time. And, you know, so as a side effect of just, you know, age and duration, I mean, if everyone was in their, you know, fifth or eighth year of their software development career. By now they're in their 18th year. And so we're all sort of grown up and we're making the commercials that we all hear, and it's all using the same damn music that we're kind of like, oh my God, the music I like is on a commercial. I think it's a similar effect.
You're talking about, we were talking about IDEs and say whatever Microsoft is doing for making an IDE appear in the browser. That reminded me that Franco Pellerini, right, made his entrance on the Plone stage. I guess I'm going to tell the story again, but 2011, San Francisco, we crowdsourced his airfare and stay in San Francisco to meet us because he had come up with the Plone IDE, which was an add-on for Plone that brought up an IDE, and you could modify your own, that Plone instance functioning through the IDE that was running in that instance. And it's like Inception, right? And so, and he's your colleague, right? He's been working with you for quite some time.
Yeah, we've been working for quite some time. Yeah. It's great. I mean, working with sort of high quality people is one of the best parts about open source, is that, you know, people who tend to gravitate towards this area, especially if they're out of college, they're usually probably a little bit more confident with themselves and, you know, are okay with, you know, want to tinker and are up for showing, hey, check this thing out that I built. And I guess it self-selects for, you know, a set of people that are just a little bit above average.
It seems that way. We're back to that self-selection thing. If you can get into this thing, if you can get into the club, you must be worthy of the club. Kind of like the internet, but that I've said this before to others, that the people I met in Plone have all been, well, it's like Lake Wobegon, everyone's above average. But it really seems that way, that people who are answering questions or helping out in Plone or just being helpful in conference calls and want to reach out because they see that you've got a problem that they've already solved and they want to put you together, connect you with these other people who can help you too. It's phenomenal. I'd never experienced a group of people who are this smart and this nice. So helpful. Yeah. And I think that's got to start with you and Limi, because I mean, if you guys hadn't set that tone, and you also set the first conferences up, so you brought these people together in a certain way, and was it your idea, the sprints, or is that Zope?
Yeah, so I think the sprints were a side effect of basically a move to sort of testing and agile at Zope Corp. And I want to say it was Trace that came up with that idea, where basically just people getting together for a short period of time and just dedicated to a topic or two, and or just pick your own.
How did you end up with that first job doing Zope? Was it, it was at Zope Corp, or was it just
No. So it was, so the first job or the first place where Plone got deployed was a friend of mine who I'd worked at his company. It's my first real job, I guess. And I was doing a bunch of, Windows development, on an accounting system called Great Plains. I think it's still around.
Oh yeah, sure.
And so I was doing all sorts of, for him specifically, it was a tracking of parts, and a lot of sort of handling data going between different countries and tracking shipments and such. And the owner of the company and I just really hit it off. And we always stayed in touch. And I had done all the work that they needed. The company eventually went belly up after I had left, and for other obviously, you know, accounting, you know, money issues. And then he, as we stayed in touch, he ended up becoming the CEO of a traded company. I think a publicly traded company or something on the pink sheets or something. And they were looking for an intranet. They had five regional offices, and they needed people to put documents in a certain place, and so they could be reviewed in Houston. That was where the headquarters were. And I think that they were, you know, like China, Italy, Brazil, and some other countries. And they just needed to sort of roll up a bunch of data. And they needed sort of public web presences for some things and their intranet. And so I came up to him and said, hey, listen, you know, we've been working on this project and you could take a look at it. And it was before they got their CTO. Maybe I don't remember exactly what the order of events were, but we showed it to him, and yeah, everyone did their part, and we ended up rolling out a software that kind of worked. It worked well enough, and until they probably replaced it about 4 or 5 years later.
So the first deployment of Plone in production was an intranet. Well, partially an intranet, but also
public. It had public websites, but it was mostly intranet, and it was on Windows as well, which was nightmarish.
All right. We need to do like more episodes with you because I got so much I want to cover with you. But let me stop before I keep going. But is there something you wanted to talk about in this interview with you? Because, you know, you're going to be back for at least two more. But was there anything you wanted to say to people who are watching or listening about, like, do you want to, you know, ask forgiveness? What are some of those decisions that you made that you kind of look back on and you go, oh, maybe we shouldn't have done it that way?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, if I were going to, well, there's a lot of decisions that made that were pretty miserable. But I mean, on a whole, I think everyone that I met used Plone as a really great learning project and really wanted the best for the project. And all the people that I met through it, I'm really grateful for having met them. I mean, they all really added something to my life in some way. And I remember, you know, a whole ton of people, and some of the things that I've heard them say were, you know, really, really quite sweet. I mean, it was just really, really nice to hear how they, you know, looking for a project that was sort of like-minded people. It did something. They found interest in it. They used it. They could make money off of it. And they really enjoyed hanging out with the people. And that kind of alignment, it's kind of Star Trek in some way. Right? As far as forgiveness, I mean, I would definitely kind of a pompous asshole in the beginning of the project, and it was really kind of difficult for some subset of people. Not as difficult as Lemmy, but I was pretty difficult. I was difficult. And, but I mean, you know, we were all very young. And it was, it's really exciting. I mean, mm-hmm. It was, I learned a ton and, am really, really humbled by even thinking that it's still a project that people are using.
Yeah. And that you helped enable all these people. I don't know, thousands of people. Yeah. I don't know, maybe more. You've touched like probably hundreds of thousands or millions of people through Plone, through the software, not let alone just the developer community and the integrators who've used it. So, I mean, that's got to be something to be very proud of, that you can look at and say, my gosh, I did this thing, and it came about because I was lurking on IRC somewhere and talking to somebody about some code I was interested in writing.
It's that random.
That's so strange, isn't it? You mentioned Windows, and mm-hmm. I remember well, it was 2003 when I first started looking at Plone. And I remember that in Fold, you were doing a lot of work supporting Plone on Windows, including like Plone on Windows servers and the proxy and the desktop. So that integration, that living, having Plone live on Windows servers is something that I associate in my mind with you guys, with you and Fold. And that's something that since you've kind of hadn't continued doing that work, the installer support and so on, that seems to have kind of fallen off, unfortunately, the Plone radar. So the developers who are working on Plone still are not Windows people. They're Linux people or they're Mac people. There's like such a small subset of developers who are Windows. And yet we still see that, my gosh, there's still interest in Windows installers. And go like, how do we solve that problem? But anyway, you were really big in the Windows space. Are you still doing a lot of work with Plone on Windows?
No, I mean, I don't know if we have any customers on Windows anymore. I mean, most of our stuff is, you know, either on client sites or us hosting it in some way on Linux. That's definitely another episode we can go into. Writing commercial products is a whole nother venture that I was humbling. But the reason why we even got into that space, I'll be honest with you, is Andy McKay, who is one of the co-founders of Infold. Genius guy. He was a big Windows guy as well at ActiveState, if I remember correctly.
And he was so ActiveState, my gosh.
Yep. Because ActiveState's a Canadian company.
Yes.
And Andy.
We don't toot our horn very much.
And some of the people at ActiveState were like, that was a whole nother sort of, you know, varsity or group of people that were just amazing. I mean, really amazing programmers over there. So that's a whole other thing. But Andy was working, I asked Andy if he wanted to come, we'll work together and we'll start a company. It was Andy, myself, and a guy who had worked with in Houston, who was kind of like a project manager slash, he's a public accountant, CPA.
And is that Toby?
Toby, yeah. And I was like, hey, Andy, you know, we might be able to just like program and maybe get some money and maybe build some stuff and we won't have to deal with any bureaucracy. This guy, Toby's like, you know, rock star when it comes to making sure that records get filed and everything. You just don't have to deal with that. And so he was like, you know, count me in.
No idea he co-founded Infold with you. My gosh.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't talked to Andy in a few years. Unfortunately, something had come up. He and Mark Hammond, they were both working at Mozilla as of 3 years ago. Time flies. So they were coming down to Austin for a Mozilla conference and something came up on my side, probably something kid probably related or something. And I couldn't meet up with him. There's a lot of things like that I really do regret, you know, if I could have figured out, you know, really kind of figured out some other way of dealing with whatever issue, you know, whatever. I'm sure I could have overcome that if I would have figured out, if I were a little bit more smart or a little bit more energized or something, because because those personal relationships that Andy and Mark and I had are just really, you know, invaluable to me. Mark Hammond was on the phone with me when I was a part of my life, an event that sort of burnt into my memory banks, where my wife was pregnant and she asked to go pick up a pineapple and anchovy pizza or something from this pizza place. And so while I was on the way there, it was in the evening, but that Mark is in Australia. So I was on the phone with Mark as his day started. I was talking with him and I don't remember what the conversation was about, but I was annoyed with Mark, or we were maybe annoyed with each other. And we were trying to talk about something. And for whatever reason, it was probably me not understanding whatever the topic was at that point. And so I hung up the phone with him And I was at the pizza place. I had driven to the pizza place, waiting for the pizza, on the phone with Mark, talking to him, maybe even pacing around outside my car, getting frustrated and finishing the conversation, putting my phone down, turning around and having a gun being held up by gunpoint.
Whoa.
And I think I may have even blamed Mark. I said, Mark, see, if I wasn't so pissed off with you, I would have been able to pay attention to my surroundings. I don't think I said that, but yeah, that was a distinct event that kind of was burnt there. And, but I mean, not being able to keep in touch with those people is kind of one of the more, it's growing up in general, but it's one of the bigger losses. You know, I really, really appreciated my time with both of them.
I remember in San Francisco, you brought your wife and at least one daughter.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, we've known each other for a while now, and occasionally when we would talk, you'd say something, well, I'm doing this with my family, we're doing that with the family. So I think what you've lost, maybe in terms of opportunities to stay in touch with people Duplone or your original crew at Enfold, you've filled it in with things that are obviously very important to you, and you're doing a good job at that. So, you know, I don't think you should have any regrets.
Yeah, well, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much again for joining me, Alan. It's been wonderful. Clearly, we have so much to catch up on, and it's been 2 years, so I'd love to pick up the conversation again, maybe in a few months, have you back on the podcast. In the meantime, if any of you viewers or listeners have any questions you'd like me to ask Alan next time, please send them to plonepodcast@sixfeetup.com. Thank you again, Alan.